come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Many Christians have the idea that money is the root of all evil. That is a misconception, in fact, and we will talk about that over the course of the next half hour or so. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a syndicated talk show host. He also counsels and offers guidance to those looking to break free of the economic chains that bind us. He's the author of a new book, Evangelpreneur, and I've been struggling with this all day. How biblical free enterprise can empower your faith, family, and freedom. It's our honor to welcome Josh Talley to the bunker. Josh,
thanks for having me.
Here at Skywatch TV today, and this is really interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading your book, because obviously money is something that all of us have concerns about.
Yes.
It is a serious cause of stress, heartache, divorce, among other things, and yet Christians aren't supposed to talk about money. It's the root of all evil, we are told. What is your approach to money, and why do you feel comfortable counseling people on how to earn money?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first wrote my first book, the title of that one was Quit Your Job or Die, Discover the Importance of Self-Employment. And the title was a funny, ha-ha sort of fake title until I finished the book. Then I was going to give it a real title. Mm-hmm. And I discovered in researching that book how dangerous employment actually is. Employment is the number one cause for suicide. It's the number one cause for divorce. It's the number one cause for affairs at work. It's the number one cause of teen drug use and teen pregnancy in a home. It's the number one cause of stress. Like, it is just dangerous. Not only is it dangerous, but it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. 4 out of 5 Americans are at or near poverty. 1 in 2 don't have $500 in the bank. And that book got a lot of attention. I was talking to a lot of groups, and churches started inviting me in to talk about it. And I noticed the phenomenon in Christianity that, like you said, it's a taboo. You don't talk about it.
Right.
And the reality is that the Bible talks more about money than it does heaven. The Bible talks more about money than it does salvation. Yet we don't talk about it at all. Jesus even uses entrepreneurship in part of his parables, for goodness sakes. And we ignore that because somehow we have two schools of thought. Either A, we're not supposed to talk about it, or B, it's some sort of weird prosperity topic where, you know, you buy my handkerchief for $900 and you become a millionaire or something.
Right, right.
And the reality is that money does have a role. God says it has a role. And when we ignore it, we suffer the consequences, which is why 7,000 churches a year go into foreclosure, which is why 4 out of 5 people, you know, are at or near poverty. And it's all because we've been ignoring it. And I wanted to write a book that changes that.
Mm. You in the book, make the case that employment is essentially servitude.
Yes.
And that it affects even our ability to serve Christ.
Oh, big time.
Now, how so?
Well, first, the Bible says you can only be a servant to one master. Your master is now who you're bonded to, which is Jesus. And the reality is when you look at the Bible's description of a servant, because that's where we have to get our definition, you look at servant and laborer, you find something extremely interesting. When you look at a servant did the work that was assigned to him, and when then that work was over, the master gave him more work to do. You worked for a certain time frame during the day. That's exactly what we do in employment. We work from 9 to 5. You know, your boss will even tell you if there's time to lean, there's time to clean.
Mm-hmm.
And then we work until someday we can afford our freedom, which is what servants did. Today we call that retirement. If you liked your boss so much that you want to stay there forever, you go to the city gate, put an awl through your ear with a ring that signified who your master was. Today we call that tenure. And the reality is that through employment, you are building somebody else's dream and it's not yours. If somebody else signs your paycheck, they control you. And that's the largest part of this problem, Derek. Your boss tells you where you get to eat lunch. Your boss tells you by how much they pay you, where you get to live, where you get to take your wife on your anniversary. Even if you get to go on a missionary trip or not, because one, you don't have vacation time, two, you don't make enough. Mm-hmm. So in reality, you're voluntarily handing over control of your life and how effectively and well and fully you serve your real master to your employer, all under the guise of, well, I have to have a job to pay bills.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned previously that even how much you tithe then is dictated by how much
yes.
you send your check that comes on the 15th and 30th of every month.
Yep.
How do we approach this then, this idea of money without getting pulled into the trap of greed, of the love of money, which is the
sure.
true root of all evil? How do we avoid that trap? Why is it okay to look for ways to earn more money?
Well, not only is it okay, but we're almost commanded to do so. And the first thing we have to do is redefine those words that we keep using, like love. What does it mean to love your dog or love your wife? You spend time with them. You think about them when they're not with you. You know, when you don't have enough time, it hurts your heart. You get sad or sorrowful. Well, that's exactly what we do with money, if you think about it. Just replace wife with money. You spend 40 hours a week making money, mm-hmm. 15 minutes a day with her. You think about the lack of money all the time. I would bet you dollars to donuts. Most people know within $2 how much money's in their pocket right now as they're listening to us. So the reality is, by telling ourselves we don't love money, we're just lying. And we do love money. That's why we constantly think about it, work for it, and earn it, and all that other sort of stuff. We also have to redefine greed, and I'm glad you brought that up. What does it mean to be greedy? And if you asked 100 people, what would you do with a 10% raise at work? They would say, I want to go on vacation. I'll get new rims for the truck. I'll buy a new flat screen. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about you, but that's me, 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 I. If you ask them, what would you do if you had $100 million? Then all of a sudden, it's, well, I'd donate money to the children's hospital, I'd build a homeless shelter, I'd get a nurse for my aging parents, and it becomes about everybody but you. The reality is, if you're the one that's saying no to your son's baseball game so you can stay an extra hour at work to make $16, that's greedy.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't want to admit it because it hurts too much down deep in our gut, which is why a lot of people, for the first half of an interview, hate me. Then in the second half of the interview, they're screaming at the radio, oh my gosh, this guy's right. So much so I even put that in the introduction of the book. You will hate this book. You will throw it across the room. And the truth hurts. But what does the Bible tell us? The truth shall set you free.
Yeah. The idea of employment has kind of been ingrained into us as a society.
Yeah.
We Americans have been raised to believe that the ideal life is you go to college, you get your degree, you go into the workforce, you get a good job working for a good company, you put in your time. Maybe not so much anymore, but I know my dad's generation for sure. You work 25, 35 years, retire with a nice pension, and then spend the golden years traveling, playing golf or whatever. And, you know, dad more or less made that work. He did have to make a job change at one point toward the end of his working career, but still, that was kind of the path that he took.
Mm-hmm.
I have not done so in part because I chose broadcasting as my first career, which is ain't nobody works more than 5 years at one company there. But my daughter's in a generation now where she's already seeing, hey, you know, all my friends are coming out of college with $25,000-$35,000 in debt,
right.
And nobody is hiring them for what they need to even pay the debt on their loans and afford an apartment and a car and insurance,
right?
Which, by the way, is now a constitutional requirement for health insurance. How do we break free from that mindset? How do we train our children to break free of that idea that we need to try to find that job to start that work career?
Well, we have to realize that an employment-based economy, which we have been for now three generations, is not sustainable. It's not possible to have an economy based on employment last more than three generations. Your dad, first generation, worked for him. Wonderful, because he didn't have to keep it ahead of that inflationary wave.
Well, and he got into the workforce not long after World War II, where
right.
we bombed the rest of the industrial world into back into the Stone Age.
Exactly.
America had a leg up on the rest of the world there.
Totally, and for an entire generation and a half. Then you get to that second generation, which is the baby boomers. Well, it kind of worked for them, but not quite so well, which is why in the 80s they came up with something called reverse mortgages, which is everywhere now. And now in that third generation, it's not going to work. They're telling people people like your daughter, don't count on Social Security. Don't count on a pension. No companies even offer that anymore, really.
Right, right.
And the reality is that because employment can never keep up with inflation, employment will never be able to sustain economies. And the reality is now we have to deal with it. And let me give you something, because I put this in the book, and I wish I would have brought it up when we did our other interview. But this is what I call the practical poverty level. These are the 12 foundational expenses that everybody has. Now, I get that these are national averages, so if you live in Iowa, it's obviously cheaper than New York City, but these are just averages. Rent, $1,000 a month. Car insurance, $144.66. Cell phone, $73. I wish. My cell phone hasn't been $73 since 1996.
I hear you.
Utilities, $264. Cable and internet, $100.63. Food, $332. Gas, $220. Car payment, $466. 10% savings for retirement, because we're all doing that, right?
Yeah.
$395. College loan payment, $575. Mm-hmm. Life insurance, $33. Health insurance, because that's a law now.
Yes.
$402. Now, you might say to yourself, well, I don't have a car payment. Great. But the reality is that nobody could argue that this is excessive or greedy.
Hey, right. Those are all pretty reasonable expenses.
You know what this adds up to?
Mm-hmm.
$70,000 a year.
Mm.
And that should be mind-blowing to anybody who has a job. Just to cover those expenses before taxes is $69,600 or $70,000.
That's before taxes.
Right.
Which means which means you have to earn another 30% beyond
No, $70,000 once you take taxes out will let you cover
Bill. Okay,
but you need to earn $70,000 in this country just to be poor. You better live someplace warm because I didn't put clothing in here.
Uh-huh.
You didn't buy a birthday present for grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why so many people are frustrated and 4 out of 5 people are one paycheck away from poverty.
Yeah.
Because this is a reality that nobody wants to talk about, especially Christians, which is why Christians are missing the number one opportunity to evangelize in the Western world.
Hmm. The idea that Christians are okay with or should be okay with the idea of being creative about finding ways to earn a living, to earn more money. What kind of resistance do you run into? I mean, you kind of allude to that.
Sure.
With, you know, people are going to hate this book, throw it across the room, whatever. Let me rephrase that question. What sort of obstacle do we need to overcome or assumption do we need to do away with in order to get to a proper frame of mind in order to secure or better secure our financial futures?
Well, we need to get off of this idea that money is evil. Like we said, it's the love of money. And we need to stop lying to ourselves. When you ask a bunch of Christian fathers, you know, what's the first thing you ask Tattoo Timmy when he wants to marry your daughter? What's the first thing you ask?
How are you going to support her?
Exactly.
Yep.
Second thing you ask, how are you going to pay for the wedding?
Yep.
Third thing you ask, what do you do for a living?
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a second, Christian dad who says money's not the most important thing. Why are the first 10 questions based on money?
And not number one being, do you know Jesus?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a way to lie to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that the Bible in Deuteronomy calls poverty a curse. The Bible says that we are supposed to financially care for ourselves, our children, and our children's children. Well, newsflash, that's wealth. You know, and it even says that God Almighty gives us the ability and skills to create wealth. But we would rather live in the lie that the devil has spun. We're kind of like Adam and Eve. Oh, you know, he did not say that you can be successful. Well, yeah, he did. And, you know, if you look throughout the Bible, even up to Paul, they're entrepreneurs. But we don't even teach that. I have a textbook that I carry with me from 1929, and it's a seventh grade textbook. It's less than an inch thick. And the first chapter of a seventh grade math textbook is how to hire employees.
Wow.
I mean, they assumed that your default career was going to be an entrepreneur because employment was the backup plan if you weren't smart enough. Mm. Now it's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And a seventh grade textbook is 4 inches thick, weighs 50 pounds. And it's nothing but hundreds of pages of repetition. So we regurgitate out kids who are just mind-numbed robots. And they just, oh, what do I do for money? And they either expect the government to give it to them or a job to continue to pay them on Friday.
Hmm. One more question on your book, and then I want to get into some of the items in the news here. And I know with the Daily Talk Show, you've been keeping a close watch on what's been going on geopolitically around the world. And some things that we talked about on Skywatch TV here that I think really worth bringing into the program here. There are people who will listen to this and, you know, after the first 10 minutes have already decided that we're talking about the prosperity gospel. How is your book, Evangelpreneur, not prosperity gospel? How does it differ?
The reality is that I wrote the book to be the antithesis of prosperity gospel. And I kind of allude to that even subtly in the introduction, because here's the reality that every listener is paying rent or mortgages. Every listener has to pay health care. Every listener has to buy food. So we need to kind of put our big boy pants on and say, you know what? Money is important to us. And I better figure out how the Bible tells us to do this, because right now we're doing the exact same thing the world is doing. And we're taught, we're told not to be of the world. Yet here we are doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So if you're an anti-prosperity gospel sort of person, this is your book. If you're somebody who needs to eat, this is your book. If you're a person who needs to buy soap, this is your book.
Hmm. Evangelpreneur is the book, and we'll give you the website where you can find out more about that and about Josh's work here at the end of the program. But I want to shift gears here and get into some geopolitics here. You brought up a really interesting topic that'll be, well, by the time this is aired, this will already be on SkywatchTV.com, one of the daily updates, talking about the changes taking place around the world because of the shift in demographics. And when you start talking about demographics and immigration, immediately you get branded a racist because you can't talk about it. In fact, I don't know if this was taken out of context or not. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but somebody posted a graphic with a quote attributed to Jeb Bush saying, "We don't have the right to pick and choose who gets to come here." And my gut reaction was, really? Then why do we have borders?
Right.
But beyond that, there is a reason that we are seeking to welcome the tired, the poor, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And it doesn't really have anything to do with fairness, freedom, or offering the downtrodden a leg up.
No. There's actually a huge secret behind all this if you really want to dig into it. And the reality is that the globe is going to be facing a massive population decline.
Now, wait a minute here. We're hearing from all of these experts around the world that the problem with the world is that there are too many of us.
Yeah.
And that's why there's starvation in Africa. And that's why the temperatures around the planet are going up, which they really aren't. But that's what it is. That's where it's being blamed.
Sure.
But the population is actually about to decline.
Yeah, evidently nobody took out a calculator, pen, and a piece of paper and realized when two people only have one kid, then in one generation when those two parents die, you have a rapid drop in population. It's actually a two-thirds decline in one generation.
Yep.
So, you know, it's taken us, I don't know, 6,000, 10,000 years to get to where we are, to get to the 7 billion. By 2050, we're going to get to 9. Mm-hmm. And people who don't know how to do math are going to say, oh my goodness, 9 billion people. But what happens when the 7 who had those 9 die? Now you have 2 billion people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the reality is that when you look at countries like Japan, the average age is 46. When you look at places like China and Russia, they're paying you to go home and procreate. When you look at even places like America, 48.5% of women between the ages of 15 and 45 have no children. So
that's prime childbearing years.
That is prime childbearing years. That's exactly right. So when half of your female population have no kids, you're going to experience a massive population decline. And it's not just in, you know, America, like I referenced China and Russia, but also the Middle East, Northern Africa, even Muslim populations are experiencing now a decline in birth rates.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a global crisis that's coming. And that's why you see places like China trying to take over places like Taiwan and the Philippines. That's why you see Russia trying to take over Ukraine, Crimea, and other former Soviet bloc states. That's why you see us allowing everybody and their brother who can get here a free, you know, house and a driver's license. Because while they keep you and I talking about the political side of this, we're ignoring the reality. And the reality is if we didn't have those 50 million illegal immigrants, not that I want them to be here, but if we didn't have them, our economy would be suffering just like Russia, just like Japan.
Because GDP would decline because there's just fewer people out there to spend money.
Exactly. Yeah. Out of the 3,600 counties or so in this country, only 12 of them are experiencing any form of population growth at all. So that is a massive secret that nobody's talking about, even to military aspects.
Well, and I want to get to that in just a second, but just a quick comment. I wish I remember where I saw this. In fact, you know what? I didn't even read this. Sharon spotted this and handed me this little data tidbit, which kind of floats around in my brain, like, you know, waiting for the right moment to come out. A couple of years ago, I think she read an article that indicated that the fastest growing religion in America. Fastest growing religious group, you know, those of us who've been conditioned by the media to be very afraid would assume that it's Islam. But no, it's the Amish.
Yes.
The Amish, because they are still having 6, 8, 10 children per family. So I wish that I had the statistics in front of me so I could back this up instead of just throwing it out there, but I'm just throwing it out there.
No, you're right, though. I saw that as well, that the Amish are growing, because unlike the rest of us who are conditioned, you know, we'll make sure you become successful. You know, part of it is it's our fault. We think, well, I don't want to have a kid at 20 years old. I'm too young. I want to go have fun.
Have fun, right.
Well, because of that, even with the segment of women that are having children, it's no longer 19 to 21. It's 27 to 30, mm-hmm. which means even those who have them are having less.
Right.
And the Amish aren't buying into that. They're living the way they have for 100 years, mm-hmm. which is be fruitful and multiply. I don't know where they got that. Probably some, you know, big book someplace that, but they're actually doing that. And that's the difference.
Yeah. We used to live in an area in Illinois that was the heart of the Amish community in Illinois. And I used to tell some of the fellows I became friends with through business that we were going to, you know, come camp out and have to learn very quickly all of the things that they already know for when things really hit the fan. But getting back to the military aspects of this, you were talking about China, and it's we've noted their aggressiveness recently mm-hmm. with regards to Taiwan, the disputed islands in the South China Sea. They're rattling the saber against the Philippines and against Vietnam and against Japan and Russia with the Crimea and with Ukraine,
even Poland,
Georgia, Russia with Georgia. And there's even a breakaway republic in an area that my ancestors, my great-grandparents emigrated from. It's now part of Moldova on the border with Ukraine, wants to break away and become part of Russia. Why are they doing this? Are they just trying to grab up a lot of people all at once? Or is, as we look at these demographic curves on a population graph, as we see that the average age, the median age, sliding further and further to the right, how does that affect military strategy?
Well, when you think about, you know, how long we've been involved in the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've been in Afghanistan now for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
That went by like nobody's business. 14 years, nothing.
We beat Hitler in what, 3?
Right.
4?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, you know, looking at a global stage now and what war really requires, if you're China and you realize not only is the stat that we just talked about true, but they were stupid enough to abort 40 million babies that mm-hmm. were female because they were female.
Mm-hmm.
So they're 40 million women short of even attempting to hit their replacement numbers.
Mm.
Well, as a military commander, you have to say to your leadership, hey, wait a second, guys. We have like a 10 to 15 year window here before everybody's too old. So if you're going to do something, now is the time we have to do it. And it applies to our military too. You know, I have on tape, I aired it on my show, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying that the reason we're allowing females into combat roles next year has nothing to do with equality and, you know, equality of the sexes. It has everything to do with the fact that we're running out of men. But this is like the biggest secret that's being hidden, because it's literally as if a comet's coming to knock out part of the world's population and everybody would flip. But if they can keep it a secret and keep us talking about the political side of immigration or the political side of China, we won't realize, hey, wait a second, they're preparing for something much larger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And keep us focused on things like the hot button social issues. We're busy arguing about who can marry whom, whether or not, instead of looking at the longer demographic trend, I just wonder, is there any way to even turn that around? I mean, how long would a pastor remain in the pulpit of one of these big mega churches if he started saying, you know, women, you need to start having babies?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a reason why some of us who have been talking about this for years, who started out as being called crazy, are now being called geniuses or Nostradamus or something, because we saw this coming. And the reality is, you can't just say, okay, everybody, you know, have babies, because you have to. One, it would cause a panic. Two, you get into this situation where you're going against the social order of the Western world. So
yeah.
The reality is, we have to have that conviction in our heart. You know, one of the arguments people give is, well, you know, who would want to have a baby in this crazy world? The answer is you. That's God's solution. Be fruitful and multiply. So even if you think the world's going to hell in a handbasket, the answer is have babies. So at least more people like you are here as opposed to people like the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So to be honest, I don't know. I don't know what we do to fix it. Mm-hmm. To a very large extent, in countries like Spain and France and Greece, which, by the way, are the same ones that needed bailout.
Right.
And they won't tell you that they're actually connected.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it funny how France, Spain, and Greece all have population or fertility rates that are below required population rates, They're the same ones that need the bailout. They're the same ones that we know are going to cease to exist. So even in those demographical areas, we find ourselves in a situation where you have to have a conviction of heart to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to pick up the mantle here and have a family.
Hmm. Yeah, the future belongs to those who care enough to show up for it.
Exactly. The
Trans-Pacific Partnership,
yes.
That is getting some attention in the alternate media. The mainstream media seems to be just kind of ignoring it or taking the administration's handouts on talking points, because I'm not really seeing any analysis that gets into any of the things that we should really be concerned about in the TPP. And, you know, we don't really know everything that's in it, but some things have been made public and they're a bit disturbing. What is it that concerns you the most about the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, I think its existence, period. You know, the origin of the TPP, the purpose of the TPP is to basically strip nations of their sovereignty, to strip the power from the people. Free enterprise has always been and will always be fuel for freedom. And when we lose that fuel, when these trade agreements come along that only empower the elite multinational corporations, it strips the power from the people to fight for freedom. But that's kind of broad. In addition to that, more specifically, things that concern me are the fact that they're getting away with country of origin labeling on meat. If you have ever heard a story in the news about swine flu out of China or bird flu out of Japan, that should scare the bejeebies out of you, because your beef could be coming from Vietnam and your Kroger grocery store is no longer going to have to tell you. So they're just things like that. The regulation on medication is going to go through the roof. The regulation through these sort of agreements, I had a term for it earlier, I can't remember, but it's like de facto legislation.
Yeah, regulation without legislation.
Yes,
yeah.
Regulation without legislation. Because what they do is they say, okay, well, you know, we're going to shut down America's last smelting location, which happened late last year, and no country that's in this agreement can sell ammunition to any country that's part of the agreement. So now all of a sudden they're taking away – they're not saying, well, Derek, let's take away your Second Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. They're just going to take away the bullets. So, you know, you still have your right. You just don't have a bullet to shoot. So they're doing a lot of things like that.
Hmm. How big is the TPP? How many countries are involved? How much of the world's economy?
It's over 40 countries, and they're estimating up to 80% of the global GDP is going to flow through the TPP, which should scare anybody who earns a paycheck, because that is massive. And anything that's big, I mean, the key to liberty is the same thing to financial success, which is keep things small. Many currencies, many nations. When you start eliminating nations, when you start eliminating currencies and creating essentially a new world order, which is what this is, you also increase the risk that's associated with any sort of collapse. You know, if you have 700 countries and two of them collapse, no big deal. Mm-hmm. If you have 700 countries and 600 of them are in one agreement and it collapses, everybody dies.
Yeah.
So, I know we don't have 700 countries, but it's just an analogy where the more conglomerate this becomes, the more risky it is. Even if it works, it's even risky.
Hmm. The tribunals. That are part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's something we didn't cover in the interview on Skywatch TV, but that is an aspect of this that really disturbs me. Somebody, a country can be sued by a corporation for potential loss of future profits?
Yes. See, this is where it gets beyond freaky. They want to tell you that this is good for trade or something. It's one, it's not. But two, every agreement like this comes along with government organization. It has to. The EU, for example, started out this exact same way. It started out as just a trade agreement. Now the EU has its own court system. They have their own military response team. They have their own navy. Like, it is crazy what trade agreements turn into. And this one's going to be the biggest one the world has ever seen.
Hmm.
So along with that, yeah, you know, even though it's evil, it makes sense where you're going to have some sort of legislative body to side with the people doing the trading as opposed to the country that they're doing the trading in, which is where you get sovereignty squished down for profit and the people who are trading elevated.
Hmm. Yeah. And while it is an issue with, I think it's a big issue here for Americans in that these tribunals will have be able to rule on things and supersede domestic law.
Yes.
Because these tribunals will be staffed by corporate attorneys. Basically, the guys who represent these corporations in court on a regular basis will be the ones sitting on tribunals hearing these cases and ruling on them. But when you start getting into countries that aren't as wealthy as the United States aren't as able to defend themselves? I mean, do they really to afford the legal expenses to defend themselves in some of these tribunals? You can have multinational corporations with a lot of clout going into places like Vietnam, for example.
Yeah.
And suing Vietnam over local restrictions on trade that may harm an American company and getting its way, being able to tell, a smaller nation state what it has to do to accommodate, Coca-Cola,
right.
for an example. It's disturbing, and yet we have not, well, as with the Iran nuclear deal, have not seen what's actually in this agreement.
Oh, exactly. And what we're talking about right now is just based on what we have seen. And you have situations even existing before TPP where large multinational corporations go into a country that can't afford to fight, and they start losing mineral rights. They start losing water rights. They can't even get their own water, for goodness sakes, in some of these countries because corporations have sued the snot out of them, and it has to come through Nestle or whatever. And we're going to see a lot more of that in reality. And it goes beyond just that. It's going to affect Americans too. Because just like, you know, how Obama said, okay, we're no longer going to spy on your phone calls. Actually, it went from, we don't spy on your phone calls. Well, then you had the leaks. Yeah, okay, yeah. We do spy on your phone calls, but now we're going to stop. Well, the reality is they didn't stop.
No.
All they have to do is route that cell phone call to a cell phone tower in Canada and back to you. You won't even notice the delay. Mm-hmm. It now became an international call, and they're back to listening to it.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing is going to happen through TPP. If you think, okay, well, I have a blog talk show and I have the right to do it. Well, no, not exactly, because the blog talk stream system that you use, we just routed through Vietnam and we're going to supersede your right to free expression. So you could be cut off just because you have the internet, for goodness sakes. And they can make it so detailed that let's say you don't like the internet, but you use the internet to process credit cards for your small business.
Mm-hmm.
But that credit card processing machine goes through Vietnam. So in so facto, you are no longer allowed to sell shirts that say American Proud because that's discrimination. Yeah. And while we're not taking away your right in America, you're violating international trade commerce law, so you're out of business.
Mm. And bringing it back around to the premise of your book, Evangelpreneur,
sure.
How does the entrepreneurial mindset help you prepare for increasingly intrusive government regulation?
Well, you know, that's probably the biggest question I get is, Josh, you know, I want to start a business, but with all the regulation and red tape, to me, that's a clue. That's like Sherlock Holmes saying, well, why do you think they put red tape on it? Why do you think they wanted to keep you out of that playground? You know, it's kind of like the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he not want you to know the truth? Because once you know the truth, you realize how powerful it is. And the reality is that entrepreneurship gives the people the power to fight back against things like this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm praying that it's not too late, but even if it is, even in total oppression, you still only have two options. Be a servant to somebody else or be an entrepreneur. So even in total tyranny, let's say martial law happens or let's say China invades, as an entrepreneur, you still have a leg up compared to your employment-based lifestyle. So my suggestion would be, if you don't like TPP, if you don't like what the Obama administration is doing, start a business by the time we finish the show.
All right. And Josh, where do people find out more about your book and your daily show on the Genesis Communications Network?
It's pretty simple. They can go to joshtolley.com, joshtolley.com. They can buy the book anywhere. If they buy the book from me, I'll autograph it. But they can buy it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever books are sold. I think you guys might even start stocking it soon.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to joshtolley.com to find out about my online courses. We have a Tully Academy that we're going to be launching in a matter of days to teach people how to do this from a distance. We also hold two-day Small Business Big Solutions intensive workshops where people can come and essentially change their life in a matter of 48 hours. So it's all there. Just go to joshtolley.com.
All right. Josh Tolley is the author of Evangelpreneur, the host of the daily talk show between 9 and 11 Central Time on the Genesis Communications Network. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
As always, I'll put a link to Josh's website in the show notes at vftb.net. Well, I don't always put a link to Josh's website, but you always put a link to the guest's website in the show notes. And since Josh is this week's guest or this episode's guest, you will see a link to joshtolley.com at vftb.net, where we've got all of the past episodes of A View from the Bunker Archive, going all the way back to number one. And this is up to number, 264. And that's not counting the unnumbered episodes that we recorded at the various prophecy conferences over the last 4 or 5 years. Speaking of There'll be an announcement on next week's Skywatch TV that you won't want to miss. Just saying. In the news, well, you know, I guess we'll continue the theme of discussing economics, or at least some of the things that affect us in the natural realm. The Chinese economy is once again sliding. We had talked about that a little bit previously, and that is of interest because it will have an impact here on the economy in the U.S. Talked to some friends recently in the steel business, which you probably know I left in order to partner with, for Sharon and I to partner with Tom Horn here at Skywatch TV. And the steel industry, which is one of those that's an early indicator for the economy as a whole, because it's a raw material used for construction, for manufacturing. And right now things are really not going well for the domestic steel industry. Before I got into the steel industry, I was under the impression that most of the steel that we purchased here in the United States was produced overseas. That is not the case. Steel pipe, to some extent, there's a fair amount of import in that market, especially certain segments of the steel pipe industry, those types of pipe that are used for power plant applications. Domestic mills tend not to make the kind of high-pressure piping that you need inside the guts of a power plant. But as far as structural steel goes, plate, beam, structural tubing, like square and rectangular tubing, you know, steel angles, you'd be amazed when you begin to look around at how many things around you are made from basic steel shapes. At least I was when I began to realize it. Anyway, most of that stuff is made here in the United States. Most of it is made from recycled material, crushed up and shredded cars and washing machines and refrigerators and so forth. It's actually pretty green material, although you wouldn't think so. Anyway, the steel industry, cost of steel down about 30% from where they were a year ago. And a number of mills, domestic mills, are shutting down operations because there's just not enough demand to keep them going. That indicates that the industries that use steel for maintenance, for manufacturing, for fabrication, construction, are really hurting. Here in the Midwest, I can tell you that the coal industry is taking it in the shorts, in part because natural gas has gotten so cheap, and in part because the Obama administration really doesn't like coal. Secondly, the ag industry is hurting. Manufacturers of agricultural equipment are struggling because we've had a couple of years of just absolute bumper crops of corn in the Midwest. Essentially, the sale price of corn right now, the going price of corn, is below cost. So farmers are struggling. They're not spending money on new equipment, and that means companies like Deere and International Harvester are struggling. What's the other one? CNH, Case New Holland, places like that build those big combines and so forth are just really not having a good time. So and power plants are putting off scheduled maintenance, you know, the shutdowns that they will schedule so they can go through, make sure everything is working properly. Because, operating costs are running real close to margins right now. So things are not good in the domestic economy as is. And then the Chinese economy is beginning to drag us down. Since 2014, the Chinese had pegged their currency to the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar had been getting stronger over the last couple of years, last year and a half or so. In that time period, since early 14, the U.S. dollar has gained roughly 20% on the euro and about 25% on the Japanese yen, about 12% on the South Korean won. And those are three currencies used by three of the biggest trading partners for China. Now, with the renminbi, the Chinese currency, pegged to the dollar, as the dollar increased in value, the Chinese renminbi, or yuan, also increased, which made their exports, their products, more expensive for foreign buyers, like Walmart. So in order to make their exports more competitive at a time when Chinese stocks are sliding, they've lost something like $4 trillion. Is that right? $4 trillion? Yeah, I think so. in paper value basically just evaporated in the span of the last couple of months. The Chinese government has decided to devalue its own currency to make its exports cheaper for foreign buyers. And so they've devalued the currency about 4% against the dollar over the last couple of days. And that's not necessarily a good sign for domestic manufacturers here either. If it's cheaper to buy it from China than it is to make it here, obviously we're going to buy it from China. We Americans love our cheap shoes and electronics. So, so some troubling signs economically on the horizon regarding the impact coming from the Chinese economy, and things here domestically not great anyway. There's some leading indicators that are heading downward. And I don't say this in the spirit of be afraid, be very afraid, but in the spirit of be prepared, be very prepared. Other things, wars and rumors of war. Russia and NATO, as we've talked about in recent months, engaging in military exercises in Eastern Europe, Ukraine in particular. Ukraine enduring its heaviest fighting in about 6 months as that long-running rebellion continues there. But with Russia and NATO both engaging in military exercises relatively close to one another, the chances of an inadvertent confrontation developing into an actual shooting match increases. So that's something to watch. The Kurds are widening their war against the, or rather the Turks are widening their war against the Kurds. Turkish Air Force carried out 17 strikes on Kurdish targets yesterday. That's Tuesday. The Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK in the American acronym, English acronym, which is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. Department of State, by the way, has been agitating for independence for Kurds from Turkey, especially for about the last 30 years. And a lot of people have died as they have struggled to free themselves. The southeast part of Turkey is majority Kurd. The Turks don't want to let go of that territory. And so the Turks are taking advantage of this opportunity, the opportunity being creation of an ISIS-free zone in northern Syria to carry out attacks on the Kurds as well. The Kurds are ostensibly American allies in this war against the Islamic State, and the Kurds have been the only military fighting force in the Middle East that's been able to put up a fight to withstand the Islamic State. So on the one hand, we've got our allies, the Turks, who are now allowing us to use their airbase at, what is it, Incirlik? I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, to launch airstrikes against the Islamic State. But in exchange, they're apparently getting free rein to go after the Kurds. So things are getting a little strange there. And adding this to the mix, and I really don't know how to process this because I'm certainly not an expert in this area of the world. I'm not a geopolitical expert at all. Who am I kidding? Azerbaijan says it's ready to go to war with Armenia over a territory that's been disputed between the two countries for a couple of decades. This territory is called Nagorno-Karabakh. And the Armenians have essentially occupied that area and some additional land from Azerbaijan besides. Azerbaijan is preparing to use force to take it back. If you look at a map, Armenia and Azerbaijan are just north of Iran and just east of Turkey, wedged in between Iran on the south, Turkey to the west, Georgia and Russia to the north. Azerbaijan is on the Caspian Sea, where they've got quite a bit of fossil fuels, natural gas and oil that they're pulling out of the Caspian Sea. But if you look at the map, you'll see that there's a region called the, and I won't get this pronunciation either, the let's just say there's another region of Azerbaijan that's on the far side of Armenia, kind of like Alaska is separated from the United States by Canada. So there's some tension there as you get regions in close proximity of different ethnicities that don't like one another. Russia has been overflying Armenia with its jets since 2012, and the Russian government has said that if Armenia and Azerbaijan go to war, Russia will intervene. Now, Armenia their motive for war, besides just wanting to hang on to this territory, is that the Armenian government apparently is very unpopular at home. And any student in history knows that there's nothing that unifies a people behind an unpopular government than an external enemy that they can demonize. So the Armenians, the Armenian government anyway, might have something to gain by going ahead and giving the Azeris a fight. So the thing that struck me as I looked at this map is that the Kurdish territory that the Kurds would like to develop into an independent Kurdistan, which they almost got right after World War I, but somehow the lines on the map got erased, includes the area right up to the Armenian border, pretty much. I mean, the Kurds are a majority in eastern Turkey right up to the Armenian border. And on the Iranian side of the border, right up to the Armenian and Azeri border. So what happens if this... I don't know what the odds of this are. Again, I'm not a geopolitical expert, especially not in this part of the world. But it just struck me as, perhaps a match being dropped into Tinder? I don't know. The other thing that struck me about all of this, and I mentioned this on the daily update today for Skywatch TV, is that this part of the world, when you look at maps, you know, those maps in the back of your Bible about the Table of Nations, where the people dispersed after the Tower of Babel incident, the descendants of Japheth basically headed to this region here. And many of the nations that are mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 38 are gathered in this region. Magog, Togarmah, Gomer, Tubal, Persia, of course, being Iran, Gomer, Magog, you know, that basically you're talking about modern day Turkey, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Iran. And of course, the northern parts of Iraq and Syria, including the Kurdish peoples. Those are basically the areas that, with the addition of Libya and Ethiopia, that come against Israel in the Gog-Magog War. So I'm not saying that this is going to develop into an Ezekiel 38 situation, because these people seem to be busy fighting each other. Israel doesn't really seem to factor into things there right at the moment. Although I will remind you that it was just within the last couple of months that both the president and prime minister of Turkey have said publicly that all good Muslims should be working toward the I'm paraphrasing, of course, working toward the recapture of Jerusalem. So we'll see how this develops. It's just, just some weird stuff going on out there, and wars happening for what looks to me, being an outsider looking in, no real good reason. Of course, the meme continues that we're supposed to believe that we're really aliens, Martians to be exact. Another major media outlet reporting an interview with a scientist who says support is growing for the theory of panspermia. I don't see that the evidence actually supports it. The evidence seems to be that more scientists are open to the suggestion. Finding organic molecules in space basically means finding molecules with carbon atoms, which doesn't seem like a very difficult thing. But perhaps it's easier for an atheist to believe that somehow a chunk of rock got blown off Mars and landed here and caused life to begin here. A biologist at the University of Washington basically quoted it by New Scientist magazine, making the claim that, the odds are pretty good. The case for Mars as the origin of life on Earth is pretty good. His exact statement, Peter Ward, biologist from the University of Washington. That begs the question, where did this biological material on Mars come from? Turtles all the way down. So, the reason that this is being reported by the news is not necessarily that they've discovered anything new. It just seems that there's a regular drumbeat out there that we're supposed to, drill into us, you know, like Chinese water torture, drip, drip, drip. If we see enough stories claiming that, we've been seeded here either by accident or by intelligent aliens, we will somehow believe it. And in fact, the Vatican, once again, kind of weighing in this. Not the Vatican per se, but Father Jose Funes, who's the Vatican chief of the Vatican Observatory at Mount Graham in Arizona, quoted again in the news, well, today, as saying that, yeah, alien life probably exists out there somewhere, but Jesus probably wasn't sent to them. Well, okay. Why even go there? Why even go there? I would suggest that maybe a better tack is the one that we try to take, which is that, you know, there's no evidence of alien life out there anywhere, that the reports and accounts that we have of unidentified flying objects, the accounts of experiencers or abductees here on planet Earth, is strikingly similar to accounts of those who've been victims of satanic ritual abuse. So that what we're dealing with is a spiritual phenomenon, not a visitation by visitors from outside the solar system. But, oh, by the way, if you have a proper understanding of what it means to be God's imager, created in the image of God, one of God's imagers on planet Earth, even if by some chance extraterrestrial life really does exist, and an alien steps out of a craft on the White House lawn, that should not impact your faith. The biologist from the University of Washington said, of course, that it's us fundamentalists who cling to the idea that life only exists on Earth because it would be a major blow to our faith if we were proven wrong. No, not if you understand that being God's imager on Earth means that we are God's moral agents on Earth. And the existence of Zeta Reticulans does not change our status in that regard. Love to have a cup of coffee with the alien from at Zeta Reticuli and discuss life on their planet, if one exists, which I don't believe. But it would not change my faith in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. Nor would it change my status and your status as a being created in the image of God here on planet Earth. Coming up this weekend, we talk about some really esoteric stuff. We get into some of the imagery of the culture around us, things that we are exposed to by through the media. In fact, one of our guests actually called the filmmaker Stanley Kubrick one of the most successful alchemists in recent history. We talked to Paralandra Kilns and Mark Flynn. Paralandra is the archivist of Mark's brother David's work. David Flynn, author of Temple at the Center of Time, Sidonia, The Chronicles of Mars, and Mark, of course, the author of the recent book, Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth, a mind-spinning discussion we had last night. You will hear that on Sunday, August 16th, as we talk about the serpent and the rainbow. And then next week, Wednesday, August 19th, interview I just concluded, in fact, we'll talk about catastrophism. The idea that Planet X is about to return, or Planet 7X, if you prefer, what role it may have played in Earth's history, and what it might portend if, in fact, it is due to return. Mark Combs, author of End the Beginning, will be the featured guest on that program. And again, you'll hear that program on August 19th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, working its way through the book of Numbers. We just recently had a several chapters that were just really fascinating, and that was the encounter with between Moses and the Israelites and Balaam. And in fact, the Israelites probably didn't even know that Balaam was talking to the king of Moab at the time. But it is another Christophany in the Old Testament, the angel of Yahweh, who appears sword drawn to block the path of Balaam, the oracle, the seer, who was traveling to the king of Moab to curse. He'd been hired to curse the Israelites, and the angel of Yahweh blocked his path. And interestingly, only one of two places in the Bible where the angel of Yahweh is depicted with his sword drawn. The only other time was when David was being judged, King David, for disobeying God and ordering a census of the people of Israel. And he looked up and saw the angel of Yahweh, sword drawn, ready to punish the people of Israel. And we talked about that. That's posted, as are all of our Bible studies, at gilberthouse.org. usually posted by mid-morning on Sunday. And we hope that, well, we hope that you join us as we continue through our chronological chapter by chapter, verse by verse study of the Word of God. Skywatch TV airs on Tuesday nights on the Christian Television Network. If you've got Dish or satellite TV, rather, either Dish Network or DirecTV, you get the Christian Television Network, DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 p.m. Central Time. And again, a big announcement coming up this coming Tuesday night, August the 18th. Is that correct? That's right, August 18th. Yeah, so I will say no more until then. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin O'Cloud, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.